From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Today we go to Latin America and the Caribbean and speak with our reporter from south of the border, now properly known as Stephen Sefton, after we retired Tony Solo to the reporter's nom de plume retirement home last week. Right, Stephen, okay. Welcome. How are you?
Yeah, thank you, Million Don. Things here are very busy as usual. There's always far too much to report about. So perhaps we should start with the latest meeting of the Bolivarian Alliance of the Peoples of Our America.
Correct.
The ALBA.
Yep. Sure.
They have various different councils. One of them, probably the most important, is the Political Council, which is where heads of state and foreign ministers convene to discuss common policy among the ALBA countries for whatever is the or are the issues of the day. And so these days they've been meeting via the internet, and they have quite a strong agenda, or they had quite a strong agenda this week, because they're having to coordinate their different policies about regional integration, and also their policies to do with addressing the COVID-19 pandemic and the economic consequences of the effects of the pandemic all through last year, 2020. Of course, in the case of three of the ALBA countries, Nicaragua, Venezuela, and Cuba, have been subject to illegal unilateral sanctions on the part of the United States and the European Union. And so they're having to try and forge a common policy in relation to that. And they were also discussing the question of climate change and the policy of countries in the South, especially Latin America and the Caribbean, of course, with regard to how to formulate a common policy petition with regard to climate change and the way the rich countries are failing to meet their obligations, and in particular, of course, the United States. So one of the things that came out in the message of the Nicaragua's representative, who's a very interesting guy called Dr. Paul Oquist. He's been a veteran of climate change negotiations over the last 20 years, and he's a veteran of Nicaragua's strategic policy team. He's the person who drew up Nicaragua's National Plan for Human Development, which is unique in its kind, as far as I can see, in the region. He made a very strong presentation to the ALBA meeting in relation to climate change, and in particular the obligation of rich countries to the countries in the South. And I've forgotten what the figures are, and I think it's something like eight of the main world economies are responsible for the great majority of the carbon emissions that are supposed to be causing climate change. And Dr. Oquist made the point that the countries that, like Nicaragua, that have not historically been the cause of the carbon emissions that are supposed to be causing climate change, are the ones that are worst affected by it. So one of the things that they're going to ask at the Glasgow Conference of Parties, which is on climate change, which takes place later this year in Glasgow, in Scotland. One of the things that they agreed in this ALBA meeting to do was to demand that the UN climate mechanisms set up a fund putting loss and damages on the same level as the concept of mitigation, because in past climate negotiations, the different COPs have approved a fund to assist poorer countries, less developed countries, especially countries that are the worst affected by the effects of climate change. They've agreed funds for mitigation, but now Nicaragua is proposing that they go a step further and recognize damages that countries, especially in the Caribbean and vulnerable areas like the Caribbean and Central America, the damages that those countries have suffered as a result of the emissions caused by the very wealthy countries. So, and it'll be interesting to see how that progresses once the climate negotiations get underway again. The other thing that they made a very strong statement about was the rejection of those unilateral sanctions, in particular in the context of the report by the United Nations Special Rapporteur on the effect of sanctions on people's human rights in Venezuela. And the reporter, I think her name was Elena Doohan. I'm not sure what country she's from. She might have been from Belarus or another country that is more independent of United States influence than the usual countries that end up contributing reporters to the UN. And her report was extremely critical of the unilateral coercive measures and their effects on the human rights of people in Venezuela. And she urged, through the UN, that the United States, the European Union, lift the sanctions that they've been imposing on Venezuela, which is essentially contributing to crimes against humanity, especially in the context of the current COVID-19 pandemic. So there was that. And what else? I'm just having a quick look through the... Yeah, and they recognized the contribution of Cuba to the fight against COVID-19 and the way that Cuba's Henry Reeve Medical Brigade has helped so many countries cope better with the effects of the pandemic. And they hope that Cuba will, and it's Henry Reeve Medical Brigade, will receive the 2021 Peace Prize, for which they're being put up as a candidate. The other thing that they do is they welcome Bolivia back to the ALBA organization and recognize that its government is recovering democracy for Bolivia's people. So in the regional context, that comes on the heels of the meeting with, the meeting between Alberto Fernandez, the Argentinian president, and Andrés Manuel López Obrador, the president of Mexico, which I think we briefly touched on.
Yes, we did last week.
Last week. Yeah. And so what you've got there is a reinvigoration of ALBA with the reintegration of Bolivia, and hope to reintegration of Ecuador, which if Andrés Arauz wins the elections, the second round of the elections in Ecuador in early April, it's that one of the first things that they're likely to do is to rejoin ALBA. And the reason that's important is because it puts more impetus into a progressive initiative for regional integration, which is very complementary to what the Mexican and Argentinian presidents were talking about when they met last week. So that's, and you and I have on various occasions pointed out the development of progressive initiatives in the region and the back and forth between the progress of those initiatives and then the setbacks that they suffer from time to time as a result of US and local allies regrouping and managing to, for example, overthrow Dilma Rousseff in Brazil via and the President Lugo in Paraguay by means of soft coups.
Right.
And also, in the case of Bolivia, where they succeeded with an extremely violent coup, and what the United States and its local allies have been trying to do in Venezuela for the last, ever since 2002, really, when they staged the first coup.
Right.
So
and Honduras, by the way, the same, because Honduras withdrew. 2 years after it came in, after they got rid of Mel Zelaya, the U.S. forced him out.
Right, that's right. And so you have this constant process of progressive initiatives in the region being set back by U.S. intervention, and that's got in effect nothing to do with what people talk about. Pink tides and conservative restorations, as if these things are somehow neutral,
or if they were forces of nature. That's the real mask when it's actually the actions. Using that language, I mean, we're talking about what looks like a process of either accretion or what's the converse of that with erosion. Like you see the beach either eroding or being added to by the ocean. The pink tide, so to speak.
Yeah, in the case of Latin America, you're talking about this very steady progress that the United States and its allies can do actually very little about. And why?
That's
because
right.
The great majority of people are just not going to give up the chance of a decent life.
Right, the reality check is this. The first agreement for ALBA was between Cuba and Venezuela, and that was signed in December of 2004. Now, you had two countries. You ended up with a whole bunch of other countries in the region piling in. And by the way, just for a quick reference, the original agreement had to do with doctors and teachers going from Cuba to Venezuela in exchange for oil. And petrol products going to Cuba from Venezuela, and then they found their own method of calculating this in a sort of a currency, and then people in the area started to realize, by example, that integrating in all different ways their economies and other aspects of the societies were mutually beneficial to everyone involved. So they all started to pile in here: ALBA, UNASUR, CELAC, all these other organizations either sprung up afterward or had a big, massive recruitment of new members and intensification of relations because they saw the example here. And even after losing, you lost Ecuador at one point, probably have that back. Bolivia lost it, got it back. Honduras still waiting. All of these, you now have, 10 permanent members or 11 permanent members at the moment, and observer members, and much of the region is deeply involved in this, regardless of the U.S.'s best efforts. And this, by the way, was something that was put together after the rejection of the Free Trade Agreement of the Americas.
Yeah, absolutely. And that brings us to the role of China, of course. And so what you've got is, on the one hand, you've got these revolutionary governments like Cuba, Venezuela, Nicaragua, working through the ALBA initiative. You've got more social democrat-style progressive leaders, certainly in foreign policy terms, like Manuel López Obrador and Alberto Fernández. And so in their different ways, they're promoting kinds of integration that explicitly reject attempts by the United States to intervene in the region, and explicitly reject spurious mechanisms like the so-called Lima Group, which has completely faded away from the scene now, but even just a year ago or 18 months ago was playing a leading role, led by the United States and also pushed by the United States, in terms of tormenting Venezuela and worsening the conditions of life for the people of Venezuela. Now, the Lima group has kind of faded practically out of public light now. And one of the reasons for that is the contradictions that are developing between the desire for the right-wing elites to want to stay in good favor with the United States, but their material economic interests, which are much better served by developing a strong relationship with China.
Right.
And so, you know, in those different ways, the United States is getting squeezed out in terms of its influence in the region. And one of the ways that it is able to kind of counter that is by stressing its military presence in the region. And it's, and perhaps we can talk about that in more detail in another program.
No problem.
But the effects of that in the region are not good, and it caused significant public unrest. And actually, I've been surprised. And perhaps it's because I'm not living locally in places like Ecuador or Argentina. I'm surprised that there hasn't been more pushback at a popular level against the presence of the United States military in countries like Ecuador, in countries like Argentina. And you can see their effect in countries like Colombia, where they are actively assisting in the destabilization of Venezuela, and also giving support to, essentially to giving support to paramilitary organizations that are murdering social leaders and trying to sabotage the peace agreement between the Colombian government and the former FARC guerrilla fighters.
Right.
And so, yeah, and also that's another aspect worth noting of the ALBA declaration yesterday, on Monday. They stressed again that all countries in the region had signed up to a declaration, I think under the auspices of the Organization of Latin American and Caribbean States, CELAC, which declares Latin America a region of peace, and excludes any toleration of threats of military violence in the resolution of conflicts. So, which is very different from the OAS, for example.
I mean, we have. There's so many things become apparent when you look around the operation of the various organizations in this region, whether they are the organizations that have been put together by the nations of the hemisphere themselves, like ALBA, like UNASUR, like CELAC, and then those that were put together by the United States more or less as a corral for those nations into the... ranch of the master in Washington, like the OAS. And watching, if you want to, again, use that tired metaphor of the tide, watching the ebb and flow of both membership and relevance of the organizations, either of the U.S. or of the other nations of the hemisphere, from time to time, you can more or less see who is winning in the tug of war at the moment by looking at the rise and fall of influence of those organizations.
Right. Yeah, and it's difficult to understate the importance of the Organization of Latin American and Caribbean States, CELAC, because it's an organization that explicitly excludes the United States and Canada.
Right.
And it was the first organization that united all of Latin America and the Caribbean on terms of equality between all countries in the region, as a body that was able to negotiate one-to-one with countries like the People's Republic of China, for example, or with the European Union. And this, Fidel Castro never tired of stressing throughout his life, it's only when countries, the less developed countries in the so-called South, combine that they're going to be able to stand a chance of defending their interests against the imperialist powers. So that's, you know, that's another reason why the reinvigoration of ALBA, which was really the motor for the original development of CELAC, the Organization of Latin American and Caribbean States, especially as a result of the impetus given by Comandante Eterno Hugo Chavez Frias. And I see that this reinvigoration of ALBA as a harbinger of a new impulse, in CELAC, and that is likely to take things forward another step in terms of the development of the region's relations with China in particular.
Yeah.
And of course, we've been talking about this broad stuff, but there are lots of little minor things that have been happening. One is that yet on Sunday there were elections in El Salvador, and somewhat to my surprise, the current president Bukele, President Bukele, did very, very well. His party is a party called Nuevas Ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm very skeptical about that, because it just seems to me that it's a new way of proposing the standard right-wing cell of cambio, of change. And in all through the 90s and the early 2000s, the right-wing parties would come out with a slogan of change to make their political sales pitch. And Bukele has been very clever in remarketing that and using the slogan, his party name, Nuevas Ideas, new ideas, and he's now got a big enough majority in the legislature in El Salvador to change the constitution if he wants to. He has what's called a qualified majority, which enables him to make changes to the constitution without needing to combine with other parties. And the surprising thing has been the almost complete disappearance of the former leading revolutionary party, the Farabundo Martí National Liberation Party, the FMLN. They did very, very badly. They were municipal elections and legislative elections for a total of something like, I think it's around 260, a bit more, municipalities. and the FMLN dropped from controlling 64 to only controlling 44.
Yeah, they went from 24% to just under 7.
Right. So they had a disastrous election. Whereas Bukele now controls, I think it's over 125 municipalities. And he has this a very strong majority in the legislature.
57 out of 84.
Right. So if you ask, well, why is that? Especially given his very unconvincing policies during the COVID-19 pandemic, which indebted the country in order to cover the costs of shutting down the economy. The main reason that he seems to have done so well is popular support for his policies trying to eliminate organized crime and the Maras, this gang culture of gangs called Maras,
yeah,
who terrorize the population, demand extortion money, protection money, and are extremely violent, responsible for very atrocious crimes. And Bukele has taken a very hard line against the Maras and has had some success in that regard. And that's probably the explanation of why he's done so well, because that gang culture was one of the overriding considerations that people were voting on in those elections last Sunday.
Right. You know, meanwhile, if you take a look at the numbers, there are a little more. There are 5,389,000 registered voters. Only 2,333,000, or less, about almost a little more than half, I'd say about 53% of the voters turned out. So,
right.
You know, and that's in the legislative election.
Yeah, and that's not unusual for legislative and municipal elections.
Of course.
But it does give you an idea of how, in general, both in countries like in the Northern Triangle, the so-called Northern Triangle of Central America, which is Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala, in general, people are extremely dissatisfied with their political classes.
Right.
And that's expressed in a significant voter abstention on election day.
Well, here too, again, Bukele's party, the Nuevas Ideas, it's brand new. They just founded in 2018.
Right, and so they really haven't had time to disappoint people.
Nope.
But they will.
Next time they will. That's right. It's, you know, it's one of the things that you say going into politics is that I'm running for, no, I haven't had my first felony yet. You know, they wait till they get in. Look at Peru, for example.
Well, yeah, and also in Ecuador, in all these countries, there are scandals about the elite cornering vaccines and getting themselves vaccinated,
right?
And leaving the general population to wait until whenever the vaccines get rolled out.
Yep. Yeah. Well, you know, here in the United States, we do it differently. We have a company like Johnson & Johnson, for example, who took what everyone thought was the safest compound that could possibly be marketed, baby powder, and with the off-label uses that were encouraged in one way or another, in any event that they've been held liable for, induced cancer in women who used it to store their contraceptives and to powder themselves, that rather than it being, we find out it's not safe for babies, but it's rather full of asbestos. These people now, suddenly, in the midst of this pandemic, where they're rushing drugs to market because it's an emergency, we have Johnson & Johnson just coming up with a brand new vaccine coming to market with full support of the federal government.
Yeah, another interesting anniversary here, or very sad anniversary, it's the fifth anniversary of the murder of Berta Cáceres in Honduras.
And we'll have to stop here and we'll touch on that next week. Stephen, thank you very much for your time.
Okay, you're very welcome, Don. Talk to you soon, I hope.
Same. Yes, we will. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio,
I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.